You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 362. And in this one, I chat with Johnny Say. Johnny is a UK-based therapist. And in this episode, we talk about secondary spikes in OCD. But before that, he shares what he learned at the Sigmund Freud Museum, secondary spikes in OCD with examples, recycling resistance, acceptance and commitment therapy skills for secondary spikes, a theory on why the brain is doing this, depression, and some of these secondary spikes discussed in this episode include obsession switches form, analysing the technique, switches from a core fear of threat to a core fear of unhappiness, what if this isn't OCD, resentment, interactions with sensations, and more. So I think this is an important episode. It's something I've seen a lot, people getting tripped up by secondary spikes. So I'm glad Johnny came on to discuss this with me. And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers effective and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories, or the link will be in the episode description. And thank you to you guys, as always, for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Johnny.
Welcome back to the show, Johnny.
Great to be here again, Stu. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. So before we get into the topic today of secondary spikes, just anything you want to share as an update or anything you've noticed or learned? Or
well, I mean, in terms of updates, I think this topic today is a big one of what I've been seeing in people recently and something I've been working on a lot with people. I also did a 10-week ACT Skills for OCD recovery course, and it was one of the things I observed a lot in that course was this secondary spike. So I've really given it some thought and sort of clarified it. So I think that's the main thing in my head really today. Excited to get into it, to be honest. But yeah, the course was something I'd ran and hoping to run again in the new year. And this is really a key part of what we're working on in terms of barriers to recovery and where people get tripped up later on.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. So definitely want to hear all about that in a second. But one question just came to my mind. So we took a day trip to the Freud Museum in London recently.
Yeah.
Obviously, that was where he moved after leaving his home in, was it 1939 or something like that? And he was only there for a year before he passed, sadly, or just over a year. But then his daughter continued living there, and obviously his other family members, but his daughter being Anna Freud, who also pursued psychoanalysis. So I guess, you know, something resonated with you quite deeply there. And I just wondered if you wanted to share that, if it's relevant.
Yeah, there was a really interesting part of the tour. Basically, the lady was showing us around, and she said she picked up this sort of statue of a porcupine. And she told us this interesting story where Freud was about to go off to America to share his ideas. And they said he was uncharacteristically anxious. So normally he was quite confident, as you might imagine. If you've ever seen a photo of Freud, he certainly looks quite a confident guy. And the way he wrote his ideas and was so definitive, you know, you can hear the confidence in it. But he was quite anxious going on that trip. And so people asked him how he handled that anxiety. The thing I found so interesting was he didn't go and do analysis. He didn't dig into his history and try and find out, you know, what was causing this upsurge of anxiety, you know, which he felt was because it was a new audience and it was really important to make an impact in America. So what he said he did was planned what he had to communicate, got that plan in place, and then you focus on something of interest and engagement. So this was the porcupine because he was interested in animal biology. So he just immersed himself in learning about the porcupine. Other times it was archaeology, and you know, that was the way he worked with his anxiety. And I thought you could see a lot of the early sort of ideas of some CBT ideas in there, right? You know, action planning and doing preparation and not over preparing, but preparing as much as needed. And then, you know, in ACT, it would be focusing on a valued interest. And, you know, in CBT, you know, you could call it distraction, but, you know, I imagine he did it in that kind of, you know, the anxiety is not going to go away. So it's like acceptance and focusing on something he cared about. So I thought that was really interesting. I wondered if, you know, that was some of the stuff that led to you know, Beck switching from psychoanalysis and developing CBT, because apparently everyone said in the circle, you got to find your porcupine. That became a psychoanalytic phrase. So yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I think it is. And it's almost a shame maybe he did clock onto it, but we don't know. But it's a shame he let's say he didn't clock onto it and be like, well, maybe there's an integration here, maybe there's some more practical tools we can do within psychoanalysis to help people. So still go to the past, but also do something practical.
Exactly.
And that would have completely changed history and sped up CBT probably. So anyway, yeah, it's interesting. Glad you shared that. Definitely worth checking out if anyone's interested. So let's get into it. Secondary spikes, what are they?
So I think, you know, everyone knows the primary spike, the main way your OCD is presenting, the sort of main obsession, whether it's, you know, worry-based, doubt-based, judgment-based, the words, the images, the emotions, the sensations, combination of those things that is really the main thing bothering you. And what I think of as secondary spikes is you apply your skills on the primary spike. So in an ACT frame, you do diffusion, you do acceptance of the feelings, and then you refocus on values. In CBT, you do the response prevention, you drop the compulsion. So you apply those tools and then OCD generates a secondary spike. So it comes up, it sort of switches form, or it changes some quality that hooks people back in. And we'll, you know, list some of the common examples, and lots of people have talked about these examples. So, you know, it switches to something and we get hooked again into the mental or physical compulsions with that sense of, oh, I got to do it just to be safe, or you don't even notice it's happened. Actually, with a lot of clients I work with, they don't even know these secondary spikes are coming up and you know, are hooking people. And or it does the classic thing, you can't quite see it as obsession and compulsion. So, you know, we miss it because those obsessions and those compulsions sort of disappear get mixed. So, yeah, that's really how I think about the secondary spike. Yeah, so, you know, I think this happens in other mental health challenges. I think you see it in depression when you apply techniques there. I think you see it, I mean, I see it with clients with psychosis, with eating disorder, with all kinds of different challenges, addictions. When you're trying to break an addiction, your mind will generate secondary spikes to kind of tempt us and pull us in and give us reasons to do it. So I think it's a very common thing. And actually, it's an ancient idea in traditional meditation. They talk about this, that you apply mindfulness and your mind will do certain you know, certain reactions to it, like, you know, doubt will come up or judgment will come up. And the advice there, which is really where I draw, you know, the idea of how to work with this, is you recycle, you know, that reaction. And I call that recycle the resistance. So we'll get into how you do that. But really, the idea is that you recycle the way your mind is resisting, you apply the technique again, you either diffuse the thoughts, accept the feelings, or if you're doing traditional ERP, you let go of the compulsions again, and you keep doing that. So, you know, definitely got a lot of ideas on how you work with that and how to identify and practice this. Got some really common examples. I think they're the greatest hits with these sort of secondary spikes, certainly things I see in a lot of people. Should I go into the, you know, the way it presents, or is anything
Yeah.
you wanted to
Yeah. I think that's a really good introduction. And yeah, I definitely want to hear about the way it presents in a second. But yeah, this is, as I said to you off air, a very common thing I hear in my private practice, or, you know, I've resisted the compulsion, or I've done dropping anchor or some diffusion skill or mindfulness skill. And then suddenly, it's triggered me on something else. It's brought up some other idea or some other worry, or it's changed theme, or it's just repeatedly coming back and back and back. So it is very much something I hear a lot, and something I find people can find quite hard to kind of stick with the repeated energy of the brain, you know. And I guess I just wanted to, I don't know what you think of this, but how I kind of sell it to my clients is that the reason your brain's doing that, at least this is what I believe, is that downstairs part of your brain that's anxious, it literally just wants you to survive, right? Nothing more than that. It's not trying to hurt you. It's not trying to bully you. It just wants to keep you alive or keep you safe. So if it's triggered and you kind of distract yourself or refocus or something else, it's going to keep reminding you, hey, don't forget about this threat, because it doesn't want you to die or get hurt. So it's that part of your brain's job to keep reminding you. And our job in the upstairs brain is to keep trying to show it, hey, you don't need to remind me. And eventually that downstairs brain will get the hint and calm down. Is that?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's definitely a big part around threat. So as you're saying, you know, it's really frightened of whatever the core fear is. And it's basically looking for further uncertainty around the core fear, because, you know, your threat system is saying this isn't safe yet. But I think also sometimes it is around the happiness core fears and the unhappiness, the core fear of an unhappy life. So your mind is going, you know, I've got to look at for other ways I could be unhappy here. And, you know, so it's rather than the danger, it's switched to the unhappiness or the need for certainty, the need to sort of clear up the doubt. And I think there's also, you know, a sort of addictive piece, and people have talked about this in, you know, there are various theorists who've sort of mentioned this, that compulsions have this addictive dopamine hit that, you know, drives them. So sometimes I think it's also the brain, you know, potentially trying to get us to keep doing the thing that's somewhat soothing, you know, and all seen clients where they're doing a physical compulsion and they know, you know, they really know it no longer maps onto, you know, even the risk they perceived anymore. But there's something soothing about just continually washing the hands, continually checking something, or continually, you know, ruminating and self-reassuring and analyzing. So I think, you know, I think definitely threat, but also something around happiness, something around certainty.
Yeah, really good point, really good clarity. And I like the dopamine idea. We obviously know compulsions are rewarding, because that's why we keep doing them, because we get that sense of relief, right? But yeah, for me, when I say danger, I mean, it doesn't necessarily need to be a physical threat. But like you said, I perceive like being unhappy is a danger. It's a danger to your well-being. Yeah. Not a deadly danger, but an existential danger, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I think you're right. Given that psychoeducation, given that idea to your clients, and then also just the factor that sometimes we have to be continuous with our practice. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think of it as gentle relentlessness. So we're relentless in how we apply the technique, the ACT skills or the response prevention. And we just do it relentlessly, but with gentleness. So we're not grabbing on, trying to do it too tight, too controlled, just over and over again, like a river carving its way through the ground to create this big valley, this sort of new neural pathway. And, you know, I think that's one of the hardest lessons to get people to do, because often we're on autopilot, so we don't even know we're doing compulsions, and it's sort of hard to get these skills in place because of that, or it feels exhausting, you know, it feels like too much effort, or, you know, we start to doubt that it'll work. So for me, that's one of the key things, is when OCD is really intense, it's this continuous practice. Like for me, when I was struggling all day long for many weeks and months at times, you know, I'd be, you know, working the skills, working the techniques. And sometimes it's not so intense. You know, you'd have a difficult hour where you're doing this sort of stuff on repeat, and then it would ease off and you're back engaged in life and things are either in the background or they've dropped down a bit. But that kind of message, you know, once I have a client doing that, I'm always more confident that they're going to get a quicker recovery because there's that determination and that commitment. And that's true of anything in life, right? If we want to get good at anything, we've got to do it that way.
That's true. Yeah. If you practice the piano 5 minutes a day, you're not going to become Mozart, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
Even Mozart practiced a lot. So I'm assuming he did anyway. I don't know that.
Yeah, he did. He did. And a lot before he wrote, I think his father was a music teacher. And so he started training him on things very early. So, is often the way. And people have natural levels of this stuff. You know, some people have more awareness of their thoughts and they can catch this stuff. They're less on autopilot, so there is a range, like anything, you have a natural capacity, but everyone needs to train, everyone needs to practice.
Yeah. And I think I find that's the hardest thing to get across to pretty much all my clients is that, for dropping anchor, for example, that skill or urge surfing.
Yeah.
They might say, I did dropping anchor, and it's like, okay, but I want you to keep doing it as you need it. It's not just a one. Sometimes it might be one off, and you feel a bit better, or you get that distance to re-engage in something else. But otherwise, like, keep doing it. This is and same with self-compassion, I find.
Yes.
Continually engaging in that compassionate voice.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a really important one because self-compassion has these secondary spikes. So we try to be compassionate and our mind gets frightened of it or distrustful or distracted or, it triggers more inner critic. So again, we have secondary spikes with compassion as well. And that's something to do continuously and relentlessly, definitely.
Mm. Cool. So let's go into some of the ways it manifests.
Yeah. So some of the key patterns I see in my clients, the first one is the obsession switches form. So, it may have been presenting with words, so verbal obsessions, and it goes to images. So the images get intense, or it switches to feelings. It's like the whole thing gets summarized into a feeling and you just get in this anxiety or doubt or a confusion or disgust or shame, or something's coming up as a feeling. And, suddenly that hooks you again because you're like, why would I be having this feeling, or why would it be so intense? Or, sometimes the images can get more intense. So they start with sort of banal, you just get in repetitive images of whatever the trigger is, and then it ups in intensity. So, with sexual or harm, OCD stuff, it gets more graphic or more intense with, things around checking and danger, the catastrophe, perceived catastrophe gets more vivid and more frightening. I think it can switch from uncertainty to judgment. So it starts with a what if question. What if I'm this kind of person? Or what if this thing happens? And it flips the judgment. It goes, you are this kind of person. You're going to do these things, or this is going to happen. This feared outcome is going to happen. It can switch emotion. So you've had a lot of anxiety, suddenly you go numb. Or you've had a lot of anxiety and suddenly the shame gets stronger, or, the kind of thoughts and feelings can sort of bounce off each other and it can, ricochet around this sort of stuff. So, that would be the first one, switching obsession form. Related to this, we can have theme hopping and blending where it jumps around different sort of core themes. I had this a lot near the end of my recovery where I was really struggling with health anxiety, and then it was hopping to existential stuff and death anxiety, and then it would go back to old stuff around harm or sexual themes, and it would sort of all meld together. And it's like we were saying earlier, it's just looking for the danger and looking for that uncertainty and trying to find it. And that was when I was first experiencing that, it did catch me out, those secondary spikes at times, and I'd suddenly be back into the rumination and the mental compulsions. Another big one, which I think is sort of inevitable, is analyzing the technique. So, this can happen with ACT skills. It can happen with ERP skills. We start analyzing, what's happening here. Am I doing it right? And get perfectionism in there. We can sort of doubt the technique and doubt, will it work, or am I doing it right? Or, we can start to say, is it a obsession or is it a compulsion, and get really, caught up on things like that. Or, is this compulsive? Am I suddenly doing these skills compulsively? Or, You know, within ACT, you can get uncertainty around any of the processes, diffusion, acceptance, values. You know, people often start doubting their values. You know, people get caught up around recovery fears, like it can switch to, you know, it moves from the core theme we've had to like, will I ever recover? Will I be stuck with this, you know, always? I think, you know, related to this is what Stephen Phillipson's called the two-tail spike, where it sort of, it jumps around, like what's the right therapeutic choice here? You know, should I expose to it? Should I do more the response prevention? Should I hold this in awareness? Should I, you know, let it go? And all of that sort of stuff and kind of questioning how you do response prevention. So really it can get very analytical about the technique, you know, and how we're doing it and what we're doing. And really the core fear is we're going to get it wrong and not recover. And, you know, be in misery or the feared outcomes going to happen. Another big one that I see often is it switches from the core fear of threat to the core fear of unhappiness. So we were talking about that at the beginning, that, you know, it goes from like, you know, a harm fear, like I'm going to hurt someone, you know, or any of your themes, basically it's hitting you with that. And then you accept that and you stop doing the compulsions, you refocus on life, you let those thoughts, those obsessions come and go without responding. And then it goes, the obsession's going to be here all the time and it's going to be really intense and you're going to be miserable and you're not going to live a happy life and it's going to distract you and stop you functioning. And so we've gone from like, I'm scared, I'm going to do this bad thing or this bad thing's going to happen to me or my family, to my life's going to be bad and I'm going to be unhappy because of OCD. And then we're back into ruminating and worrying and analyzing, you know, about that. You know, common to all of these, I'll say a few more and then love to get your thoughts on it. But there's a couple more that I think are really important. You know, another one is it often relates around this isn't OCD. We've all heard, you know, people coming up with that. We've all probably done it ourselves. I did it plenty of times, you know, really asking yourself, what if this isn't OCD, or the statement, this isn't OCD. And it's kind of common to all these secondary spikes, but, you know, it'll often be because of its switching theme or the way it's showing up, or, you know, it might go into our history. It might pull something out of our history, something that's happened or something we did, or the kind of false memory, real event type stuff, and start going, because of this, because you once did this, or, you know, it'll pick something that we're not proud of that's really is unrelated to OCD, but it's something we do honestly regret. And it'll kind of link those together and start, you know, going, well, that's, you know, why this is an OCD. And people will often find something unique about their learning history, something about them, about their sexual development, about their relationship with emotions and anger, with their, you know, experience of contaminations and threats, or things being missed and things not being checked, something in their history, you know, something about relationships, it'll pull that out and go, this is the reason that this is an OCD, and you know, we'll get stuck in that. Couple more really important ones, resentment. You know, it switches to how much I hate OCD, how much it's ruining my life, you know, anger, resentment. And sometimes that's, you know, it's a checking compulsion as well that comes about because I don't like this and I hate OCD. It must prove that I don't want to do this thing, or, you know, that I'm not this kind of person. So that resentment loop. And, you know, it can get confused here with grief. Now, of course, grief, as many people in the community have identified, is a big part of recovery. And, you know, healthy grief about what we've lost and, you know, what we've missed out of and how OCD has impacted our life, you know, is part of recovery. But the difference here is grief is an active process of, you know, adjusting to loss, and, you know, it moves through cycles of emotion, whereas resentment is stuck. And it loops, and it's like a ruminative mental compulsion. And related to this, I find you can get interactions with depression. And this happened to me at the end of my OCD recovery journey. I was getting very good at accepting all the kind of anxious thoughts, the uncertain thoughts, you know, even the depersonalization and things that it was all interacting with for me. And then I got hit with a big wave of depression. And it really pulled me back into a lot of mental compulsions about the depression and about recovery. And again, it was that kind of fear of unhappiness and look, you are unhappy and look how you're not feeling anything. So you must be, you know, that terrible person you feared. And it was like it kind of blended with depression. So, you know, people have hopelessness coming up, helplessness coming up, or it takes more the self-critical, judgmental version of, you know, depression. It's like OCD mixes with the inner critic and it just starts being like a bullied voice. And I noticed that actually in a lot of clients that have severe bullying history, they, you know, they often have this kind of merging of, you know, the obsession and the inner critic, or I've certainly experienced that with people. Or we kind of perceive ourselves as vulnerable. We perceive ourselves like, I can't do this. I can't do this recovery work. These emotions are too strong. These thoughts are too intense. If someone else was experiencing this, they couldn't do it. Other people must have a milder form of OCD, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's like, you know, takes away from our strength and our courage in the sense that we can handle this actually if we're determined and we keep going. And we can lose motivation. That's one of the toughest things. Depression takes our motivation away. So we stop doing ERP. We stop working the ACT skills so much. And some people will say, you know, when I'm working on depression with them, they'll say, I can't even, you know, drop anchor like the technique we were talking about. I can't quite bring myself to do it. And that's where we got to recycle that resistance. We've got to start noticing that resistance, and eventually you'll get a big enough gap to start doing skills again and start doing exposure work again, but at least be noticing that and stepping back somewhat. The final one, I know this is a long list, but I felt all of these ones were really important and they're things that I see a lot. The sort of final one really is the interaction with sensations. And I know that Chrissy Hodges did a really great episode on this recently. So you covered a lot on that and, you know, how it pulls in physical sensations from different themes to get us doing compulsions again. I would say these are secondary spikes. So, you know, Chrissy talked about the groinal in sexual fears where, you know, we're either scanning and checking what we're feeling. And because of that, we get, you know, the feared sense of arousal, or, you know, we get the nerves firing in our body, or, you know, it's like at a body level, the obsession presents in that way. And then we start analyzing, checking, monitoring, you know, ruminating about those feelings. So that can come as a secondary spike. We accept the primary spike of HOCD, POCD, whatever it might be. And then it starts scanning the body and starts generating this secondary physical stuff. It also shows up with, you know, contamination. You know, people feel contaminated. They feel that sense of contamination that just feels so tangible. You know, imagined urges. We feel like we're about to hurt someone or move or do something, or, you know, we feel the body tightening up and about to move towards something. I say imagined urges because, you know, we talk about urge surfing in ACT a lot, and that's really about urges that we do want to do, but we're uncertain about the outcome. So if I want to eat a ton of chocolate, in my heart, I know I want to do that, but the outcome's the bit I'm uncertain about. I'm thinking that will be bad for my health. Whereas OCD, we either know completely or thereabouts that this isn't what we want to do, or we're just confused and totally uncertain about it. So it's not so much about the outcome that we're worried about there. It's more the actual urge. So that sort of imagined urge. So urge surfing, the imagined urges isn't about resisting the urge. It's about resisting the compulsions there. So it's kind of like a bit of a subtle one there. You know, sensory motor stuff presents in the body, health anxiety. You can get just weird pressure and pain. Like as a kid, I had this anxiety symptom when I was having panic attacks and depersonalization. I'd feel like my head was really tight, like someone was crushing my head. And I would get this when I was working on letting go of compulsions and using ACT skills. Suddenly I'd get these very tight, you know, physical feelings or drowsiness or depersonalization. For me, I would, you know, I'd resist the OCD and then I would feel very detached and depersonalized and like I was unreal or the world was unreal. You know, and panic attacks as well, like the physiological response of panic attack can increase. So really anything in the body can kind of come up and catch us as a secondary spike that then pulls us back in. And because it's so physical, like it can be pain, you know, and health anxiety, and feels so real, we're just back into the compulsive cycle. So they're really, you know, the core ways I see this showing up regularly. You know, this is not an exhausted list. It could show up anyway. It's anything your mind does when you apply the technique to the primary spike and it changes form somehow to pull you back in to start doing compulsions.
Really good list. I guess I don't want to talk too much about those because I don't want to dilute what you've said and how articulately you've said them. I definitely see people, you know, the spike, the secondary spike of is this even OCD? That seems to really catch people out.
Yeah.
And I guess what also came to mind is obviously you reeled off a ton there, which was awesome. But I assume just like OCD themes being infinite, so could secondary spikes.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think they could show up any way depending on your learning history, your personality, your mind. I mean, I've even had examples where people who have synesthesia, which is when you have your kind of senses can merge a bit, so you can sort of, you can see, you can feel what you see, or you can hear what you can touch, you know, your kind of senses can merge a little bit. And some people have this, I've even seen that show up, you know, people have, you know, the kind of obsession is blending with a sort of spatial sense, like so yeah, it can show up very uniquely and very differently from person to person. These are the ones, you know, that I see so often. So I wanted to list those, but it's really, it can be anything where you distrust your senses as well. People start distrusting, you know, what their senses are telling them in the present moment, or distrusting their values and sense of self. And also the infinite list of reason giving, you know, the mind can give infinite sort of reasons why you should keep doing the compulsions. You know, they, of course, they all relate around some core themes, but it can show up in infinite ways, really. So yeah, I would totally agree with that.
Okay, cool. So throughout that, you did interweave some of the ways of like tackling this, working with this, but I guess maybe as a separate segment now, more to focus on that specifically, like ways people can address that secondary spike.
Yeah, the main way, the catch-all sort of idea is really recycle the resistance. So you apply the techniques, the ACT skills, or the response prevention, drop-in compulsions, and then you, whatever that secondary spike is, you apply the technique back on that. So if you're working in an ACT way, you diffuse from the primary compulsion, you let go. You diffuse from the primary obsession, you let go of the compulsions, your mind generates a secondary spike, you just do the same thing again, you diffuse it again, and you try to let go of any compulsions. Now, mental compulsions can be so slippery, so quick, so, you know, sometimes, this is why I think that it's important to have these mindfulness skills of your thoughts and feelings and have these ACT skills in place, because for me, response prevention was too hard. My mind was so fast. I was unconsciously doing this stuff for long periods of the day. I didn't even know I was doing it. And suddenly I come to and I noticed I was analyzing and judging. And for me, it took a lot of training to get more aware of my mind, to be able to observe the obsessions and let go of the compulsions. And I think a lot of people are like that. I think there are some individuals that have really good concentration, often very intelligent, very precise and focused people, that maybe they can go straight to letting go of compulsions. But I don't work with many people like that. I work with a lot of people who say, you know, I was told to drop the compulsions and I just don't know how to do that. I don't know what to do. So you're recycling the resistance, you're diffusing that reaction. And then with ACT, also working with the body, you know, so if it switches to the sensations or it switches to the emotion, then we're applying the acceptance of emotion or sensation. And there's lots of different acceptance skills, but it's pretty similar. We're just noticing, making room, opening up, allowing that feeling to rise and fall. Mm-hmm. And again, you could say in traditional ERP, it might be, okay, you just sit with the emotion for longer, you don't do anything about it. And okay, some people can do that if they have a robust sense of self, and they don't believe that it really is so dangerous, and they feel kind of safe within panic, or they feel safe within, you know, really intense emotions. But a lot of people need some help with that. You know, it's so hard to be with a difficult emotion. So again, why I would say ACT, acceptance of feeling skills, are so useful. I mean, for me, like when I was having panic attacks as secondary spikes, I really thought I was going to die. You know, I really was convinced I was going to die in that moment. I didn't think it was a panic attack. And, you know, okay, sit with that. Well, go on, you sit with that, you know, like if it's that easy, like when, you know, it's easy to sit with a panic attack when you know, oh, it's a panic attack. But if you're really fused with that belief, I'm about to die. Okay, that's a different thing to sit with. So for me, you know, using those ACT skills to recycle the reaction, and then, you know, in ACT terms, we're then coming back to values, present moment attention on actions, goals, things that reflect those values. So values sometimes gets misunderstood to mean that it's always something kind of ethical and, you know, grand, and it, you know, it's always something, you know, that's bigger than self and supporting others. But values can be as simple as fun and playing video games, something like that, through to, you know, compassion and running a charity. So, you know, values is just ACT's way of describing self-directed meaning. So it's self-directed chosen meaning. So it's something we choose ourselves and connect to and focus on. And really, it's a catch-all for those core values, but also the goals and the actions that reflect them. So we're coming back to that. And in CBT, you might just come back to the exposure, of course, and just continue with exposure. But, you know, really, it's the same principle, recycle the reaction. And if you get really good at this, like what I found was secondary spikes fire up a lot, you know, during difficult, intense periods of OCD. But if you get really good at this, you can just allow the obsessions to come and go in awareness, and you can stay engaged in life. And I talk about this as allow and engage. So you're no longer even needing to really do diffusion that much or acceptance that much, because you truly can let things rise and pass and come and go and stay, you know, connected and engaged. And, you know, people might say, oh, why do you need to focus on the present moment? Or is that too difficult, you know, too intense to do that on an ongoing basis? Well, you know, we know from research, most people are distracted 50 to 60% of the time, is what Dan Gilbert's A Wandering Mind is an Unhappy Mind says, you know, the big Harvard study they did. And when people's minds are wandering, either on pleasant things or unpleasant things, they report lower levels of happiness and fulfillment. So we want to be engaged. We want to focus in life. And for people like myself, I was distracted. I was overwhelmed with anxiety. I couldn't focus. I couldn't connect. So to train that as a way of, you know, once we've diffused from the secondary spike, getting engaged, getting focused, getting present in the things that matter in our life. You know, lots of other ideas on this. I could definitely go into more, but was there anything on that that
I'm glad you brought up values. I think it worth clarifying that obviously, like you know, you just mentioned about playing PlayStation or something, or playing a games console. So yeah, what you're saying is you want to go play the PlayStation or Xbox because you're really excited about a storyline in a game, or because you just love it or enjoy it, versus I'm going to my PlayStation because I don't want to feel this way. Because at that point, that's not values, that's distraction. And and also, obviously, there's a difference between distraction and refocusing, which you're talking about. You're refocusing on something that's important to you versus going to it because you don't want to feel this.
Exactly. So the function is different. And that's what makes a compulsion. It's the function, and anything can become a compulsion because of that. So going to therapy can become a compulsion if we're going to get a sense that, oh, I'm in therapy, my therapist hasn't called the police on me yet, I must be a good person. You know, like anything can be functionally that. So in ACT, the function is we want to move towards values, self-directed meaning, the things that will give us fulfillment and make our life enjoyable. And yeah, you're right. When we engage in that, you know, in a values-based present moment connection, we're not trying to push away the difficulty. We're letting the obsession come and go in awareness, And if it hooks us, you know, if it gets really sticky, then we're doing diffusion again and coming back. And then we're really surfing the urge to do any compulsions, any physical compulsions or mental compulsions, which in ACT would be called experiential avoidance and, you know, rumination, judgment, analysis. Steve and Russ have talked about those as experiential avoidance from the very beginning of ACT, you know, as something we want to let go of and stop doing. So, you know, and whereas the obsession, we can't do that. We can't let go of it and push it away. We have to get good at diffusing and good at allowing it to come and go. You know, to support this, I you know, often work with people to set the intention, either set the intention at the beginning of the day or set the intention before something difficult where you know you're likely to be triggered, to work your skills and set the intention around secondary spikes. So you just say to yourself a few times, okay, in this situation, when my mind gets triggered this way, I'm going to apply this skill, response prevention or ACT skills. And you kind of get that in your mind, much like memorizing a shopping list. If you've forgotten to bring the actual shopping list, you repeat it to yourself so that when you get to the shop, the trigger of the environment cues the behavior to get the shopping list. The same thing here. And related to this in ACT, they talk about a pain alarm clock. So that the painful emotional or cognitive experience becomes an alarm clock to use the skills. So it's not like we're having to be mindful 24/7 like a Zen monk and really, you know, focused all the time, ready to do mindfulness. It's more like we've got that intention, that alarm clock. So as soon as that aversive, confused, anxious, depressed, numb feeling, whatever happens, you know, the skills come. And if we train it enough and we set the intention enough and we have a daily practice, it becomes effortless, just like OCD compulsions have become effortless. Eventually, we start using the skills effortlessly and easily. We might just need to top that up from time to time. And then reflection at the end of the day, how did I do? Did I do well? Compassionate reflection. You know, and sort of working on this, you know, with clients, I do this interactively. So as we're doing values-based exposure, I check in regularly what's happening in your mind, your thoughts and feelings, what's happening as you're applying the technique. And I listen out for these secondary spikes. And I also listen out to them as we're talking, because often when you're talking to clients, you can hear them verbalize the compulsions and you can hear them verbalize the secondary spikes as well. So you can catch resentment, for example. You can catch, is this really OCD or you know, the change in form. And the other thing I like to do is to draw it out as a chain. So with a client on screen, draw out the primary obsession. And then we apply the technique, and then what happens? What's the secondary spike? And then draw out the compulsions that we're starting to get stuck in. Like, so it could be, you know, your primary spike is relationship OCD. You apply diffusion to the thoughts and refocus on your values in relationship, making the relationship good. And then it flips to a different theme. It goes to HOCD and starts you off on that track. And then you're analyzing, ruminating, going over your history, why you're not, you know, this way or you are this way. Mm-hmm. And so I draw it out with clients, and we might draw quite a few chains. And then we start going, okay, that's where we want to get the skills in at that point, after the obsession, basically. We want to get the skills in there. Or if we're in the compulsion, let's get out of it. Let's urge surf, get out of it and come back. So I really like that. I think it's a helpful tool. It really helps to have good skills. The better your skills are observing your mind, the easier it is to catch this. It sounds confusing when you first talk about it, but the more you practice, the simpler it gets. Yeah. And as a general rule, if you can't tell obsession, compulsion, secondary spike, primary spike, you just diffuse, you just step back and observe. And in time, it'll become clear what's going on.
Yeah, I like that. I think you just need a couple wins of using these skills. And then when you finally are able to step back and observe, it just clicks. Like, I get it. Yeah. I see what my mind's doing. I see what I need to do. Doesn't mean it becomes perfect from that moment, but it becomes easier because you've seen it once. And if it happens once, it can happen multiple times. So you've done a lot of great videos on these types of skills, like urge surfing, dropping anchor, loads
dipping
of
in and out the stream a good one for this.
So that's all on your YouTube channel, so I'll put the link in the show notes, so definitely people to check that out. I sometimes set your videos as homework for my clients to practice these skills, because they're really good. Also, any readers, Dr. Russ Harris's Happiness Trap book, the second edition, so the new edition, he's done a really good job of laying out these skills in words. So if you're more of a reader, check the second edition out. But I'll put a link to your videos. So let's change tracks a bit. So you can pick up the phone and call the 8-year-old Johnny. What do you tell him?
The 8-year-old Johnny needed a lot of compassion. So, a lot of compassion. He was very frightened. He was in a lot of pain, a lot of panic attacks, a lot of depersonalization, a lot of OCD showing up. So it would be a lot of compassion. It would be, you deserve love, you deserve acceptance, you'll get through this, you'll get stronger. He was quite frightened about being vulnerable and not being strong. I would tell him, you will get stronger, and this stuff is, doing that, getting through this is what's doing that. So yeah, he needed a lot of compassion for sure.
Yeah, nice. And something I noticed you said a few times, and I don't have an issue with it, but I guess I want to clarify for some listeners. You said at the end of my OCD journey, which would apply, you no longer have OCD. So I guess I wanted to see your view of recovery journey, you said.
Yeah, I guess what I mean by that is the really intense, difficult, the times when I had OCD symptoms 24/7 for weeks and months, and was really caught in this, and when I was depressed and feeling very hopeless and like I probably couldn't get through my life, I was feeling suicidal, that kind of level of intensity. Now, the way I talk about it, I like the definition of recovery of psychological flexibility. So the way I feel about it now is I feel that I can handle any obsessions my mind throws at me, and I can, stay engaged in my life. I can practice my skills. I feel like any secondary spikes my OCD brain throws at me, I know what to do and I can apply it. Now, of course, there's no certainty, that could all disappear. And, but I just feel this stuff has got in at a deep enough level that, I know what to do. If it goes back to 24/7, really difficult, I would just keep doing exactly what I'm doing, and I could live my life like that. Now, yes, I have obsessions still, as everyone does. Maybe I have more of them than your average person. Although talking to friends and talking to people, clients without OCD, you realize that people do have a lot of intense, bizarre and difficult thoughts. So, who knows? Maybe I have more of that. I certainly can still have high levels of anxiety, and I can have dips in mood and things like that that I have to work my skills with. So it's more, I guess, in that I'm not talking about curing OCD or anything like that. It's more that in really intense, like the most painful times of my life. And I feel like quite a lot of distance from that and time now from that. And I would know what to do when I got back there. And, I recently had COVID for a second time, and first time I had COVID, I didn't have much symptoms at all. It was fine. But this time it really hit me, and it hit my nervous system more. And I woke up in the morning feeling very depersonalized, and I had lots of sort of physiological symptoms and I felt delirious at times and real crazy sort of stuff. So in the past, that would have hooked me for health anxiety massively. But I used my skills and I was able to get through that. And then after that passed, I got hit with a bit of a wave of depressive mood again, similar to how I'd had it in the past. And this time I was fine. I was able to handle that. I didn't listen to my mind. My mind becomes like this existential, like one of those crazy characters you see that where they've got like an end of the world board and they're ringing a bell and they're saying everything's, going to the end of the world. Like my mind would do that and go very existentially despairing. And so it did that a little bit, and I could diffuse that fine, and that sort of rose and passed quite quickly. And then I was left with the heavy, painful, like someone had put this heavy blanket on me. It was hard to motivate and move. but I could accept that and I could be with it. I could move through it. So, you know, my definition of recovery is psychological flexibility, because I think that's how people recover. And if you hear any good recovery stories, they talk about acceptance, they talk about compassion, they talk about living a life they want to live and not struggling with the symptoms anymore. So that's what I mean. So it's not like, you know, that you cure OCD, it's that you change your relationship with your mind and then it's not a problem anymore.
Yeah, agreed. I just wanted to clarify, because I know some people can be like, oh, there's a cure. Well, what is it? You know,
yeah,
and you're not saying that. You were just saying live your life the way you want to live it, and it doesn't dominate you anymore, and it occasionally flares up and you deal with it.
But even the flare-ups, you know, like I can see the secondary benefit of, even if symptoms get harder, and they don't in that way really, but they're, you know, different mental health things do, but even if they do, I see the secondary benefit of, life is going to throw me a ton of difficult thoughts and feelings as I go through it. You know, there's only one way out of this life, and there's only one thing that happens as we get older, and you know, sickness, losing people, pain, suffering. And the secondary benefit of having this stuff is we learn a load of skills to get through all of that. And I, you know, so if I have any difficulty, I see it as, I can feel more empathy for my clients. I remember what they're going through. You know, with that depressive thing from COVID, I was reminded how hard it is to work with depression for my clients. And you're also learning skills that are going to help you till the day you die.
Yeah.
You know,
very, very good point. Well, look, thank you so much for coming on and talking about secondary spikes. I'm sure it's going to help a lot of people.
My pleasure, Stu, and great to chat with you.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast.
And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD,
head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.